Well, first of all, wow, it's warm, yeah? And it occurs to me it's important for us to do whatever we have to keep comfortable. So let's keep this informal. And feel free to move around. If you have to get up and splash some water on your face or get some water from the water fountain, please feel free to do it. I won't be at all offended that you missed some of my brilliant words, but it's okay. Looking around the room, I think I'm probably not the only baby boomer here, right? Wow, that was an interesting, a special time. And I want to talk a little bit about that in the context of Buddhism and the availability of Buddhist teachings, right? It's interesting that I/we came of age just as the ability, the possibility to practice Buddhism also presented itself. I mean, if you think about it, the previous generation, you had people like Alan Watts, D.T. Suzuki, kind of plowing the field in the sense of talking about Buddhism, and many of us read their works and we got excited about the possibilities. And then the psychedelic 60s, followed by the explosion of interest in Dharma centers, Dharma practice in the early 70s. And again, I think many of us sort of take that for granted and we don't realize how special that was, how fortunate we were, given that those teachers, those centers, like San Francisco Zen Centers, ECLA, New York, Hawaii in my case, Diamond Sangha in Hawaii, those were not available. Previously, it was just for our boomer generation that suddenly the Dharma became available. And I think it's important to sort of appreciate that. And the other aspect of it that is really fascinating is that it wasn't just one type of Dharma, right? It's like if you were a Thai peasant living in a small village, the only kind of Dharma you would probably ever be exposed to was the Theravada teachings of your local temple and the local bhikkhu, right? And in our case, pretty quickly, we had this extraordinary combination where not only Zen was available, which is what I practiced, but also pretty soon Tibetan Buddhism, Shogyam Trungpa, familiar to many of us here, and then soon thereafter, Jack Kornfield, etc., with the Insight tradition, Spirit Rock, and so forth. Again, that's quite extraordinary, quite special, the fact that these different traditions came together and came into conversation. We had journals like Tricycle and Buddha Dharma, where different teachers would be highlighted talking about roughly the same topic. Again, quite extraordinary. I don't know that there was any other time in the history of Buddhism when you had this opportunity to learn from different traditions, different teachers like that. I think we were very fortunate. It's been a very special time in the history of Buddhism. But what I want to do this morning is sort of broaden that context and talk about what I might call the globalization of Dharma. I just talked a little bit about Buddhism, but what's fascinating is at this particular point in history, we can elaborate, we can expand what I said and bring in lots of other spiritual traditions due to the globalization process, right? When we think about globalization, most of the time we're thinking about technology, sometimes politics in terms of the United Nations, economics, the fact that there's this interdependence that we're so much more aware. Communication technologies, transportation technologies, I mean, it's quite amazing. But right now, there's another aspect to globalization that's kind of sneaking in, but it's really important for us to understand and appreciate. It is what I would call the globalization of spirituality. And I think the reason we're not so aware of it is, up to this point, a lot of the emphasis is on actually clashes, right? When we think of Islam, what do many people in the United States think of? Or when you get comparative religion, when something like the Catholic Church is interested in what other traditions may say, they tend to look at it in terms of what agrees with their own tradition, and that's what's good about the other tradition, right? So there's a lot of defensiveness in terms of this coming together of all of these different spiritual traditions. But I think in the long run, if there is a long run, inevitably something has started that I think is going to bear enormous fruit in terms of appreciation of how other spiritual traditions, other great figures in other spiritual traditions, may be using a very different language. But once we really go deeply into the tradition, we can see that so often they seem to be pointing at the same thing. And that's what I really want to emphasize a bit this morning, especially in the context of our wider, let's not be too fine about it, the wider polycrisis, right? I mean, a lot of the talks that I've given in the past few years have talked about eco-dharma, the ecological crisis. But that's getting more and more difficult to talk about because it's harder and harder to separate what's happening ecologically from what's happening politically, economically, psychologically, right? It's really a polycrisis, an interdependent polycrisis. And here I'm reminded of something that the English writer H.G. Wells wrote about a century ago, maybe a little more than a century. In a way, this is kind of the motivation or the inspiration for this talk. He said, "History is a race. History is a race between education and catastrophe." He said that more than 100 years ago, and frankly, I think it's more and more obvious today. In fact, it seems to me the race is speeding up on both sides. And I'm really fascinated how the globalization of spirituality can be understood as part of the educational side of it, insofar as we are learning more about other traditions and education in the broadest sense of a deeper appreciation, you know, not only of the non-duality of different, you know, human races, human nationalities, but also our non-duality with the biosphere, with the earth as a whole. Does this make any sense? Again, the globalization of religion. So that's a huge topic. What I would like to talk a little bit about today, focusing it more precisely, is look at what Buddhism has to say, in particular about the word shunyata or shunya, usually translated into English as emptiness. I want to say a little bit about that, about how that term has been understood and transformed within Buddhism, and how it seems like something like that, again, using different language, especially God language, how that seems to be expressed in different traditions. What am I trying to say here? The globalization of religion, of spirituality, it seems to me what we're now starting to appreciate is that we have more fingers that seem to be pointing at the same moon. And that's really important, right? It's like, first of all, it's important that we don't take the finger for the moon. We don't get caught up and identified with particular teachings, but rather, I mean, it's always been clear in Buddhism, the teachings, look, Buddhism isn't a faith tradition in the way that, say, Christianity is. It's a practice tradition. The idea of the teachings, all the teachings exist, and the reason they can transform as they have historically is because they're to help us realize something. They're to help us wake up. They're to help us become enlightened. Right? That's why we say, don't take the finger for the moon. But think of what it means if you have a lot of different fingers with somewhat different language that we can appreciate seem to be pointing at the same moon. First of all, it's very strong evidence for the moon, isn't it? But it's also harder to identify, it's harder to get stuck on any particular finger when you've got so many other fingers, right? So again, I think it's really important to realize this is a special historical moment for Buddhism. Not only are we so aware of all the different Buddhist traditions, the way they've developed in different parts of Asia, but we're so much more aware of all of the other of the world's spiritual traditions. And how, again, just think about that extraordinary moment in world history. The Dharma is not simply something that pertains to Buddhism. It's something we can see, we can find in the best of all of the world's great traditions. Again, I'm really struck by that. It seems to me quite extraordinary, right? Maybe it's worth mentioning that in my very first book, I published a book called Non-Duality, and it was basically on my based on my PhD dissertation. And it was comparison. It was a study in comparative philosophy. That was the subtitle. And a lot of it was the comparison between Buddhism and Vedanta. Vedanta being the one of the main, maybe the main philosophical tradition of Hinduism. And once you look really closely at it, although the language is different, the parallels are quite remarkable. For example, Buddhism, there's this teaching anatta, which says there's no self. Maybe you're familiar with that, right? The basic idea being that the sense of a separate self is in fact a construct, right? It's the self, it doesn't have any separate self-existing reality. The sense of the self that's inside, feeling separate from the rest of the world outside, it's the way that a bunch of, you know, transforming mental and physical processes, the way they work together. There's feeling, thinking, acting, it's how they interact, and it creates this, what Buddhism calls the delusion of duality. So Buddhism says there's no self as a way of denying duality. But then you look at Vedanta, and Vedanta says, guess what? There's only self. In fact, they would capitalize S. And they talk about Brahman, and they say that the true self, the Atman, is not separate from Brahman. So on one hand, they seem to be contradicting each other, but once you look more closely at it, what they're both doing in different ways is denying the duality, denying the separation. Buddhism says no self, Vedanta says there's only self. What they're both denying is the duality of a me inside that's separate from the rest of the world outside. And when you look more closely at the parallel, you know, there's lots of other ways in which there are parallels as well. And likewise, the book talked quite a bit about Taoism, because many similarities there as well. So anyway, what I'd like to do with the rest of my time this morning is focus on one particular essential concept in Buddhism, this idea of emptiness. That's the usual translation of shunyata. Focus on emptiness and then notice how some other traditions seem to be pointing at the same thing. But first, let me say a word that there's a lot of different Buddhist traditions, right? And not surprisingly, they emphasize emptiness in different ways, right? I already mentioned how in the earliest teachings of the Pali Canon, the focus is on the emptiness of the self. This is the anatta teaching, no self teaching. As I just said, the sense of the self inside that's separate from the rest of the world outside, well, it's a construct, right? In the later Mahayana traditions, there's a lot more emphasis on the emptiness of everything. In other words, basically, according to this teaching, there's nothing that has any separate reality because everything is interdependent with everything else, including you and me, but also everything we see, everything we experience. Everything is a temporary transforming effect of how a lot of different causes and conditions come together. Nothing, according to Buddhist philosophy, has any self-existence, right? But within the Mahayana tradition, there's also another way of understanding emptiness. It doesn't contradict what I just said, but there's the understanding of emptiness as saying something about our true nature, something about the true nature of everything. And let me read it to make sure I get it right. Huh? A lot of the Mahayana traditions talk about what's called Buddha nature. And understand shunyata, the emptiness, it's not simply denying that things have any separate reality, but Buddha nature refers to an unconditioned, basic, primordial reality from which the whole world manifests. Everything is a manifestation of this primordial reality that in and of itself doesn't have any qualities of its own. Has no form, no color, no characteristics. It's, in a way, you could say this reality is a nothing or a no-thing that takes all different forms, as you and me, as chairs, as floor tiles, as fans, as windows, etc. All of these things are manifesting this Buddha, fundamental Buddha nature in their own way, right? You could say that this fundamental Buddha nature is a no-thingness that because it's nothing, it can become anything. In the Diamond Sutra, one of the most important Mahayana sutras, the Buddha says that he doesn't have any fixed form by which he can be identified, that you can't see or hear or perceive the true Buddha. He's not to be recognized by any physical characteristics because the Buddha is someone who has realized he's this formlessness. And in Zen, we have this Heart Sutra which says form is emptiness, emptiness is form. The Diamond Sutra also, at the end of it, it says we should view all phenomena, including ourselves, as like a bubble, a lightning flash, a phantom or a dream. Everything is this impermanent manifestation of this fundamental reality. Everything, in that sense, is empty. Nothing has any separate reality of its own. Everything is a manifestation of this Buddha nature, right? But now, okay, maybe that isn't totally clear, that's fine. But what I want to spend a little time is showing how this fundamental claim is found in many other different types of traditions. For example, Taoism, the Taoism in China, and Taoism was a very important component, right? My own practice tradition is Zen, Chan in China, and that was, Chan isn't just a form of Buddhism, it's what happened to Mahayana Buddhism when it went to China and it interacted with Taoism, right? So, let me give you a quotation. According to Taoism, the Tao in it of itself is a nothing, not in a negative sense, but it's the inexhaustible womb of all life. Quote, an empty vessel that we can constantly draw from, but it doesn't need to be refilled. You can say it's a nothing pregnant with being. And becoming nothing, no thing, letting go of our sense of self, is how we return to the source from which all things, including ourselves, originate. Here's a quotation from Chuangzi, right? There is somewhere from which we are born, into which we die, from which we come forth, through which we go in. It is this that's called the gate of heaven. The gate of heaven is that which is without anything, no qualities of its own. The myriad things go on coming forth from that which is without anything. The wise person stores away in it. In other words, the spiritual path is about letting go of the sense of separation and opening up to this inexhaustible no-thingness or emptiness. But what I really want to focus on, given the background that many of us have in the Abrahamic traditions, right? The Abrahamic, the main ones, as we know, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And a lot of the issue there is, you know, when you read, say, Genesis, it's very clear at the beginning, God created, he said, let there be light, and then he creates everything, and at the end he creates us, and we're the only ones made in the image of God, right? So it's very much, on the popular level, it's very much the sense of God as the super being. He's like us, but bigger, like the big father who creates us, all-knowing, all-loving, all-powerful, hopefully takes care of us, like a father, right? He wants us to live in a certain way. If we do what he says, the promise is he'll take care of us. If we don't, we're going to get into trouble. So we tend to think of God as this invisible, omnipotent, all-powerful, all-knowing, loving, all-powerful. But when you look more deeply into what I think the greatest tradition, the greatest teachers, the greatest writers within the Abrahamic tradition, when you look more deeply into what they're saying much more similar to this idea that God, it's not a duality, that God created us, right? For example, in the Jewish Kabbalah, the mystical tradition of Judaism, right? It doesn't talk about creation in the dualistic sense. Everything is an emanation. Everything is a manifestation of God. And in fact, there is nothing but God, right? There's a famous line in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 4, which is usually translated, there is no God but God. You've heard that? In fact, according to some of the great mystics, like Reb Zalman of Lindi, right, the first Rebbe of Chabad, he says, actually, that's not a good translation. It's better understood as, there is nothing other than God. Everything is a manifestation of this God, pick your language, ultimate reality, Buddha nature, right? One of the great translators within the Buddhist tradition, Edward Konza, he translated a lot of the Prajnaparamita sutras. Anyway, listen to this. This is what he said. When we compare the attributes of the Godhead as they are understood in the more mystical traditions of Christianity with those of Nirvana in Buddhism, we find no difference at all. This stuff seems to me really important, right? What is this pointing at, right? For me, the greatest person in the Christian tradition who I constantly return to is Meister Eckhart. And many of you are nodding, maybe you're familiar. Actually, Deitsi Suzuki wrote a book, Mysticism, Christian and Buddhist, where he compared Zen with Eckhart, a book I highly recommend. But let me just read a few things that Eckhart said, right? These are from his sermons. But if God is neither goodness nor being nor truth, then what is he? God is pure nothing. He is neither this nor that. If you think of anything he might be, he is not that. Again, since it is in God's nature not to be like anyone, we must come to the state of being nothing in order to enter into the same nature that he is. That always reminds me of Paul, one of the letters of Paul, where Paul says that Jesus emptied himself. Again, Eckhart still. For you to know God in God's way, your knowing must become a pure unknowing and a forgetting of yourself and all creatures. An unknowing. Something very much emphasized in Zen. Unknowing. There's also an English mystical text, The Cloud of Unknowing. Letting go of what we know, because knowing, in a way, is still dualistic. There's a me that knows something. There's a me that knows a God. And so Eckhart's most famous saying, so I pray God to rid me of God. He's distinguishing God, Deus, from what he calls the Godhead. When we're not aware of God, why not? Because we are God. By cultivating detachment from everything, right? In his last great sermon, he talks about having nothing, knowing nothing, willing nothing, that is the mystical path. He says, we come to realize that, quote, God's ground is my ground, and my ground is God's ground. So when I am able to establish myself in nothing and nothing in myself, then I can pass into the naked being of God, which is the naked being of the Spirit. Form is emptiness. You must know that this is in reality one and the same thing. To know God and to be known by God. To see God and to be seen by God. In knowing and seeing God, we know and see that he makes us know and see. And maybe this famous saying, the eye that I see God with is the same eye that God sees me with. My eye and God's eye are one eye, one sight, one knowledge. One love. Wow. Another Christian saint, Catherine of Genoa, wrote, quote, once stripped of all its imperfection, the soul rests in God with no characteristics of its own. Form is emptiness, right? Since its purification is the stripping away of the lower self in us, our being is then God. What about another tradition like Islam? I read a wonderful book by a Japanese scholar called Taoism and Sufism, Izutsu. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's basically a comparison of Taoism, right? Taoism in China, with Sufism, the mystical tradition of Islam. And he especially writes about this wonderful guy who I knew almost nothing about before, called Ibn Arabi. And again, I read this, and it just blew my mind. Because guess what? You're going to hear it again, folks, from an Islamic perspective, right? He is perhaps, Ibn Arabi is perhaps the greatest of the Muslim mystics, philosophers, and he talks about the unity of being, which for him it's very clear, nothing is real but God. Quote, "There is nothing in being or existence but God, while the entities, all the things in the world, are non-existent in the sense that they don't have any reality separate from God." Empty forms, anyone? "Everything is God's self-disclosure, how God is manifesting. The things of the world reveal him while also concealing him, because we get identified with them and we miss that everything is manifesting this God. God's essence is unknowable in itself." Why not? Well, sure, he's a nothing, a no-thing, but we know him through his name. He uses the word names, but it means forms. Know him through all of the forms, right? So for Ibn Arabi, God is distinguished from all his creatures by negating all characteristics, all attributes, right? No form, right? "God is like the color of water, which seems to take the color of the vessel that it's in." He says, quote, "The one who witnesses and the object witnessed," right? The one who sees and that which is seen, guess what? They become completely unified. At this point, it's no longer the human heart that witnesses its object, but God is witnessing himself. When the ego self is annihilated, lets go, we realize that we have never been separated from God because we've never been anything else. So Ibn Arabi, he says this, I love this, "I myself am the seeker and the sought. I am both the one who is seeking and that which is sought." According to another Sufi saying, "No one knows God but God." According to Ibn Arabi, the perfect human is like God himself, nothing specific, no specific qualities, which is why there's emphasis on the freedom. The freedom to transform, the freedom, certainly Zen emphasizes this, to be fully present and respond appropriately to whatever the situation may be. Being no thing in particular, what he calls makam la makam, the station of no station, is what enables us to do that. He talks about God as a mirror. And he says, it's the same mirror, God is the mirror in which we can realize our true nature, but also we are the mirror whereby God can take form and realize himself. It's like the mirror is how we realize who we are, the mirror is how God realizes what he is, right? He says, "We give God appearance, he gives us existence." You could say, we are how God presences, incarnates. Emptiness is form, form is emptiness. I'm reminded here too, sorry, one more Christian writer, Angelus Silesius, 17th century Christian writer. He says, God is nothing at all, and if he something be, only in me it is, having chosen me. I am as important to God as he is to me. I help him to maintain his being, and he helps me to maintain it. It's like God needs us. That's how he takes form. And there's one more thing about Ibn Arabi. Sorry if I'm dragging this out. I'm just so deeply touched by this. But there's one more thing Ibn Arabi says that really moves me. He says, those to whom God remains veiled, those who don't really realize God, you know, maybe they follow the precepts or whatever, but if they, those who don't really understand, you know, we ask, those people ask God to have compassion, right? We pray, God, please have compassion on me. But the mystics ask that divine compassion be fulfilled through them. In other words, when we are most in need of compassion, what does God do? He makes us compassionate. It reminds me in Buddhism, the bodhisattva, we have this double notion. We have these celestial bodhisattvas, like Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara, and they're kind of sort of mythic figures. But there's also this strong emphasis on the Buddhist path. Hey, the idea isn't just to appeal to these bodhisattvas. The point of the path is we are to become bodhisattvas, right? When we are most in need of compassion, God makes us compassionate. Well, so, just wrapping up, what does this mean for the future? How is this going to play out? If history is this race between education and catastrophe, you know, might this play, you know, first of all, it seems to me what we're talking about is education in the big, best, most important sense, realizing something about our true nature. What might that contribute in this race? Or is it too slow? I mean, seems to me things are breaking down pretty quickly. There's a lot of problems, right? Maybe it's not something we can help, expect much help from in the short term. But one can hope that in the long term, in fact, it seems to be inevitable that as the globalization process continues, there's going to be more and more. It's like we're at the cusp of this extraordinary moment when not only Buddhists can realize that the Dharma is much bigger than Buddhism, but there's this extraordinary globalizing coming together of all these spiritual traditions. And one can hope, and I would say I think it's more than hope. I think in some way, to some degree, for at least some people, it's inevitably there's going to be a deeper appreciation of this, that we will be able to appreciate each other's traditions for the best of what they have to offer. And that, I think, could be a very important part of how the future will unfold. So this globalization of Dharma, let's just appreciate this incredible moment, not just in the history of the Buddhism, but the history of humanity, the history of the way civilization has developed, the history of globalization, that this is part of that process, and how important it is that we find that we're having all these different fingers pointing at the moon, which is not only evidence for the moon, but also I think makes it more likely that we might practice in a way that can help us realize the moon. Thank you.